Good morning. There are some deep-thinking people in our humanist family, and reading their work and discussing their thoughts is illuminating and rewarding. The history of humanist thinking goes back as far as thinking people have lived. But through all this history, individuals have stood out, groups have prospered, but somehow all this good thinking was out of reach for me. I became a humanist in my own, as many of you have done. When challenged about my thoughts, I found myself at a loss for words. I came out mostly with, "Well, I don't believe," statements, which made me sound pretty negative. When I found the American Humanist Association definition of humanism, my search for words was satisfied. I finally had words that expressed all my belief in a positive way. I printed the definition on a business card, and I'm now always ready because I have a positive answer. I generally have one of these in my pocket. So here's a story of my journey and why I'd like people on the street to know that humanists exist. I was raised in Akron, Ohio, a place where in 1851, there was a national women's convention, and it's where Sojourner Truth gave her famous "Ain't I a Woman" speech. It's a place where in 1870, the Universalist John Buchtel founded the Universalist Buchtel College, which later evolved into the University of Akron. It's a place where a strong Unitarian congregation prospered, a city where I knew nothing of their existence, nothing. Talking about this problem one day with one of our Unitarian District our directors, he said, "Yeah, I know about that. I remember flying over my hometown and saying, where were you bastards when I needed you?" Greenville, South Carolina is the home of a strong, vibrant Unitarian Universalist congregation. But how many people in our city are struggling with doubt about religious truth with no knowledge that our congregation exists? I can identify with them, for when I started doubting, I was totally alone. My parents and my extended family all spoke the Christian story, and I did not know a living atheist. I didn't even know a doubter who was out of the closet. Brother Dennis at a Country Church of Christ revival was clear on this. He said, "Doubt was one of the first evils. The fires of hell awaited anyone who tolerated question." And I believe my cousins follow that commandment today. So here I was, a serious doubter, alone. And then in my early 20s, in a doctor's office one time, I found a Look magazine with the article, "Who Are the Unitarians?" I was astounded. Not only was I not alone, but I was in the company of Jefferson and Franklin and Priestley and the founding spirit of our country. Whew. Married to a good Christian wife who would have none of this Unitarian foolishness. I did not attend a Unitarian meeting until after a divorce many years later. I came to this group in the spring of 1976. I managed to catch the last service of the year. Charlie Smith was president then, and the GUF, it wasn't UUF then, but they didn't believe in wasting a perfectly good summer with meetings. So, returning in the fall, I plunged headfirst into this group, and I've stayed active ever since then. The UUA is a wonderful group and a perfect place for our national base, but I've never been completely satisfied with the seven principles. They're certainly worthwhile, but when asked by a stranger, "What do you believe?" I don't feel these principles are a complete answer. I have felt that showing these principles to any progressive Christian church, they probably would say, "That's a great list. Those are our principles too." For me, the one thing missing in the statement of our seven principles is the idea that they are free of supernatural guidance. If I were writing the list, I believe that probably would be one of my first principles. I remember a few years back, some from the UUA said, the goal of life is not the goal, but the journey. That was never satisfactory for me. I wanted to reach the goal. And the American Humanist Society finally came out with a written statement that did it for me. Humanism is a rational philosophy informed by science, inspired by art, and motivated by compassion. Affirming the dignity of each human being, it supports liberty and opportunity consonant with the social and planetary responsibility. Free of human need and interest rather than theological or ideological abstractions, and it asserts that humanity must take responsibility for its own destiny. Well, here finally clearly stated was what I believe and who I am. And I was so taken with the clarity of the expression that I printed it on business card stock, and I carry it with me always. When I get a chance for an elevator talk, I produce my card to support whatever I have to say. My good Catholic wife recently asked me, well, when did you decide you were a humanist? And I said, well, I've been a humanist most of my life. I just didn't have a name for it. And when she said, yeah, but I thought you were a Unitarian Universalist, I said, yes, but there's no conflict. I am a UU humanist, and I think most UUs are humanists too. The American Humanist Association is a strong, vibrant organization. The AHA recently sponsored public campaigns with the slogan, Good Without God. They put it on billboards. They put it on the sides of buses and public advertising space. With the public message, people discovered not only did humanists exist, but they were not all in the closet. The AHA is interested in forming groups, and there are active humanist groups here in Greenville. Bill Schultz said he recently saw a sign on the highway saying the Piedmont humanists were responsible for keeping that roadside clean. The AHA website, AmericanHumanist.org, is filled with worthwhile information. We have brochures from the AHA on our humanist information table, which is in the room where you get your coffee. The AHA's slogan, Good Without God, reminds me of a quote from one of their past articles. In the normal course of events, good people do good things, and bad people do bad things. For good people to do bad things, it takes religion. In the June Humanist magazine, Erdman Palmore wrote of the AHA, we don't attend to the human need for community and ritual inspiration that humans have traditionally received from religion. But I have found the answer in Unitarian Universalism. I've been a leader in several UU congregations over the past 50 years and have found them all, and found there all the community, ritual, and inspiration I need. We do not need to start new humanist denominations when we're fully accepted into UUA. We humanists are well accepted in the UUA. A visit to the website uuhumanist.com is worthwhile. So, are you a humanist? Do you think the world would be better if humanist thought were more involved in our society? The evangelists really believe, and they really think we would be better off following their lead. But they not only believe, they work at it. They attend meetings, they write letters, they get elected to councils and school boards, and they create an environment where following their lead is the only way. If we're not to be their followers, we need to be seen and heard. Pat was a leader in activism, and we need to follow his example and make ourselves and our ideals known.
Thank you, Jim. I asked our own humanist composer and musician for all seasons, Dr. John Greer, for music, and particularly an anthem that would challenge. Those of you who plan Sunday services might want to bear that in mind next time you ask the two of us to share a venue. I asked for an anthem that would musically express the emotions stirred by the challenges of the changes imposed on us by modernity, the changes that we in our 7 billion strong human mass impose on ourselves, and yet that no one of us alone controls. We are, all 7 billion of us, on one giant raft racing down a turbulent river toward a future we can't know, but somehow we cause. My response to this reality is Unitarian Universalism, humanism, that we're talking about this morning. And I would say that John succeeded very well in accomplishing my assignment. From Blaise Pascal, a 17th century philosopher, mathematician, and theologian, what is it then that man's greed and powerlessness demonstrates to us, if not that there has previously been in man true happiness, of which today only the mark and empty impression remains, a gap that he ineffectively tries to fill from the present world, seeking in absent things the help that he doesn't find in present ones. But this is insufficient, because this infinite gulf can never be filled except by an infinite and unchangeable being, that is to say, God himself. This spring, as our humanist book club, group, discussed the book Reason and Reverence by William Murray, a well-known Unitarian minister and theologian and teacher in our theological schools. The discussions brought me back, among other things, to the classical proofs of God's existence. Among them is the claim that the sense of the existence of God, a sense that many ancient writers claimed was universal, is itself proof that gods exist. Calvin called it the sensus divinitatis. Why else would anybody have that feeling that God existed, unless God put it there? Where else would it come from? Ironically, this argument parallels the type of evolutionary explanation of form and behavior in animals and plants, what's sometimes called a just-so story. A just-so story claims some feature of an animal or plant has a reason for being there that is explained by the creature's evolutionary history. That's what evolution's all about. So my explanation makes sense to me, and therefore it's the right explanation. Many of you will remember Rudyard Kipling's just-so stories, from which this phrase comes from. And one of my favorites deals with the question of where did the elephant get his trunk? It's because the crocodile, who lived in the great, gray, greasy, green Limpopo River, grabbed the elephant's originally short nose one day in an attempt to make a dinner of him. In the ensuing struggle, the nose was stretched out into a trunk. That started a fad in the elephant world, and all the other elephants flocked to the banks of the Limpopo plastic surgery salon to get the same treatment. Kipling's explanation of the elephant's trunk strikes me as about as likely as Calvin's and Pascal's explanation of the sense of God. Pascal supposedly coined the phrase, God-shaped hole in the human soul, which every one of us is supposedly struggling to fill, although that's not quite what he said, as you saw in the opening quote. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote, there is a God-shaped hole in the heart of man where the divine used to be, as a lament about today's materialistic and spiritually empty world. But I don't believe that he, a thoroughly atheistic French intellectual existentialist, proposed to correct that flaw by reintroducing God. And there is a modern theologian, one Alvin Plantinga, a Calvinist, who admits that some people don't have this sense of God's presence and speculates that the reason is due to a mental handicap of some kind, possibly induced by too much sin. And so at last I have found this spring an explanation of why my personal spiritual journey is, frankly, mundane. I like the God-shaped hole, the sensus divinitatis. Many of us humanists in our hearted edge relations, the atheist, I think share this handicap. But wait, who's to say who's handicapped here? We are perhaps talking of differently abled. Maybe in losing one ability, we, shall I call us the floating souls because we have no holes, we floating souls have gained something that others lack. Maybe we're the able ones and the others are disabled. Let's see if the atheist I mentioned could shed any light on this. The most recent atheist outbreak, led by the so-called Four Horsemen, consisting of Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion, Daniel Dennett, who wrote Breaking the Spell, Sam Harris, The End of Faith, and Christopher Hitchens, God is Not Great, launched their various Jeremiads 10 years or more ago. Their program, as it has been for many a previous atheist awakening, was to demonstrate the irrationality of at least the Abrahamic traditions with a special focus on the Christian and Jewish ones. I'll note that the Old Testament is a rich source of material for this type of exercise. That irrationality demonstrated, people would abandon their superstitious beliefs and get on the rational bandwagon. To the concept of the God-shaped hole in the human soul, one of these rational modern atheists might well respond, "No, my friend, it's a God-shaped hole in the head." We humanists feel that this response isn't going to change many minds. In the last two centuries or so, in our country and others like it, it has been physically safe, if not socially safe, to be an atheist. Why hasn't the militant atheist view prevailed, being rational, as we, most of us in this room, agree? Apparently, atheism doesn't fill many people's spiritual religious needs. The reality may be that religious spiritual feelings are a critical, integral emotional reality for many. Even if someday scientific findings about the brain can link these emotions to other physical realities, such as the genome, neuron responses, humankind's strong social adaptations, or whatever things I can't even imagine, the feelings that we have will remain as strong in us as the color blue is to our consciousness. A natural religious humanist would say that these emotional states are human mental features and not, as the dogmatic atheist might say, bugs. In fact, for example, the fact that researchers can now link up a lot of my visual system processing and with measurable physical phenomena that take place in well-mapped locations in the brain, activity that my conscious self can't sense while I read the output in my interior sensation of seeing, this external scientific view of reality doesn't detract from the pleasure I feel in looking out over my friends' faces here assembled in this pleasant sanctuary. Whatever we may learn about ourselves, we humans will live as best we can with our inherited emotional structure and all the other assets and blemishes evolution provided us with for as long as we're around. How, I've asked myself for many years, are we going to do this? I myself don't think the ancient previous wisdom will suffice. If it did, we'd all be saved right now and nothing more to do. We have no choice but to continue our journey using what started us out on it those 60,000 or 200,000 or 1 million years ago, wherever you want to start your clock, namely our wits and our social bonding. I'm not sure these two qualities can even necessarily be called separate in an evolutionary sense. We're going to have to learn new things and apply them in new ways. There'll be great risk of failures and an unknown likelihood of success. And so I come to the gnarly, conflicted, difficult to rationalize, for me at least, Unitarian Universalism. I think it will most certainly be a part of that future process. UU's historical roots are firmly Christian, although heretical. Unitarianism, an ancient heresy, had its origin in the opposition to that weird mystic construct, the Trinity. Universalism springs out of moral opposition to the barbarically logical application of the consequences of original sin to all the sinners who fall off the salvation bandwagon, including those who die as infants. But like a tough weed, UUism has rerooted, and now one of its strong roots is humanist. In Reason and Reverence, Charles Murray calls it natural religious humanism. Natural, which means no supernatural, no God needs to stick his nose in here. Religious, it admits the reality of emotions of awe, beauty, love, and others that we associate with religion. Humanism means we center on the human and how we are embedded in the interdependent web of existence. That's not the only root of UUism, though. In UUism, we can gather with those with and without God-shaped holes in their soul or heart, full or empty abysses, as Pascal would say, and we can apply ourselves, setting aside myth and superstition, to the business of improving the now and the future as best we can. We UU set aside trying to force any particular emotion-based, human cultural influenced understanding of ultimate reality as a reason for conflict or action. Hold what views on those things you please, so long as you don't consider that they give you the license to dictate to others from an unopposable seat of superior knowledge granted by a supernatural actor who directs you. We focus on the human world with its shortcomings, failures, horrors, progress, triumphs, and glories. What can we bring to decrease the first three and increase the last. We admit our responsibility to the entire world of our living relatives, from the smallest virus to the blue whale. We aspire to do what we can to improve ourselves and our world. In this shared aspiration, here in this fellowship, this church, we are all humanists.